When you hear the words Federal Bureau of Investigation, do you think of a federal law enforcement agency responsible for policing federal crimes? Or do you think of a secretive domestic intelligence agency that has for over a century been engaged in gathering political intelligence and spying on dissent? My name is Chip Gibbons. I've written about FBI political surveillance for The Intercept, The Washington Post, The Nation, In These Times, and Jacobin. I'm also the policy director of Defending Rights in Dissent, where we recently released the report, Still Spying on Dissent, The Enduring Problem of FBI First Amendment Abuse. This is part one of a limited podcast series around that report. Today, we'll be exploring the FBI's legacy of abuse, from the Palmer raids to the Black Identity Extremism Intelligence Threat Assessment. Later in the program, I'll be talking to Mike German. Mike is a fellow with the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School. He also used to be an FBI agent and recently wrote the book Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide: How the New FBI Damages Democracy. Before I'm joined by my friend and colleague Mike, though, I want to talk about the history of the FBI, what it is, and the role of the FBI in domestic intelligence and political surveillance in the United States. The FBI is a law enforcement agency, that is true, but that's not all it is. In addition to doing law enforcement, the FBI's self-described mission includes domestic intelligence. While later in this series we'll be talking to police abolitionist Alex Vitale, standard accounts of intelligence versus law enforcement raise a distinction between the two. Law enforcement is more close-ended. It is focused on solving particular crimes and presenting evidence for prosecutors. Obviously, we can talk about whether or not that's what police really do, but for now, let's deal with that assumption. Intelligence, on the other hand, is broader. It's about gathering information of political and military significance, and congressional reports and the FBI itself concedes that intelligence has a greater capacity to violate the First Amendment rights of Americans. The FBI was created in 1908 at the request of Theodore Roosevelt. His attorney general went to Congress asking them to create a federal law enforcement agency. Congress was disinterested in doing so. They feared the agency would become a secret police engaged in political spying and espionage. Congress, however, went on recess, and during that recess, the Attorney General created the Bureau of Investigation, as it was then known. To this day, the FBI has no congressional charter. This is something we'll talk about next week in our episode, Failure to Reform. We'll be joined by law professor and Defending Rights in Dissent board member Emily Berman. In 1919, the FBI got into the intelligence game. A young J. Edgar Hoover, who had previously been a clerk at the Library of Congress, headed the FBI's earliest intelligence division. This was called originally the Radical Division, but was later renamed the General Intelligence Division. What did the Radical Division do? Well, it policed radicalism. Under Hoover, the Radical Division gathered information in a system similar to the card catalog on radicals around the country. Then, during what was known as the Palmer Raids, the General Intelligence Division began rounding up and arresting radicals all over the country. The first raid was carried out on the one-year anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. 10,000 people were arrested, 3,500 were held in detention, and over 500 individuals were deported. Many of these arrests and detentions were patently illegal. Today, the FBI admits this was an abuse of power. Hoover later would become the director of the FBI, not just in charge of its radical division. Before he became the director of the FBI, though, there was widespread concern about the FBI's domestic political surveillance, so much that before becoming director, he had to meet with then-Attorney General Harlan Fiske Stone about the problem. Stone asked Hoover where was it illegal to be a communist, and Hoover agreed there was no law banning this. So Stone tried to limit the FBI only to investigating violations of the Federal Criminal Code. Whether or not this prohibition worked or not is up for debate, but in the 1930s and 40s, the FBI would again receive broad intelligence powers after Franklin Delano Roosevelt issued a series of executive orders tasking the FBI first with conducting intelligence against Nazi sympathizers, then communist and general subversives. It was from these executive powers that the FBI would use to reestablish its General Intelligence Division. The General Intelligence Division quickly recreated the list of the old Radical Division. What they did, though, went beyond that. They created what was called the Custodial Detention List, which was a list of people to be detained without trial in the event of an emergency. When Attorney General Francis Biddle learned of the list in 1941, he demanded Hoover shredded, arguing the FBI lacked the legal authority to compile such an index. Hoover did what he would often do. He changed the name of the index to the Security Index, claiming to the Attorney General the custodial detention list was gone, but with the same names were on a list with the same purpose elsewhere. It's not clear when the next Attorney General would become aware of this list, though by 1946, at least, an Attorney General was aware of the list. So, on this security index, which was a list of people to be detained in the event of an emergency, at its height in 1955, how many names do you think were on it? 26,174 people had their names on this list. In addition to the security index, there was also the reserve index. People who were not dangerous enough, not subversive enough to be included on the security index, but were too dangerous to go without the FBI prying into their business, watching their moves, and documenting their political beliefs. This list served a dual purpose, as historian Ellen Schreckner, the country's perhaps foremost historian of McCarthyism, points out. The FBI was able to parlay its list of people slated for detention into a program of widespread political surveillance. And I've seen that in my own research. A few years back, when Delmer Berg, the last surviving member of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, passed away, and John McCain wrote a very interesting obituary of him in the New York Times with the headline, "John McCain, Salute to a Communist," I requested his FBI file. I also got the FBI file for someone named Roger Wells. Who was Wells? He was no one. He was the name used to write an article in a communist-related magazine about farm workers that Delmer Berg was one of the co-authors of. The FBI, however, wanted to know who Wells was and if he should be on the security index. Also, in finding Berg's files, I could see how each and every year the decision to decide whether or not to keep Berg on the list was used to justify and facilitate continuous surveillance of him, including asking his neighbors what type of mail he was receiving. However, this list was not only surveillance. In 1950, just 12 days after the outbreak of the Korean War, Hoover asked President Truman to detain 12,000 people listed on the security index and hold them in military prisons. Truman, however, rejected the idea. By 1960, the FBI had opened over 430,000 files on allegedly subversive groups and individuals. This was truly mass political surveillance. But Hoover and the FBI were not satisfied with merely mass surveillance of dissident political views. In 1956, they began perhaps the FBI's most nefarious, most infamous program, the counterintelligence program, frequently known as COINTELPRO. What was COINTELPRO, and why did Hoover want it? In 1956, Hoover became convinced that an increasingly liberal Supreme Court would make it impossible to prosecute domestic radicals for crimes. As historian Schreckner explains, Hoover and his men then decided to use dirty tricks instead of criminal prosecutions to neutralize the Communist Party. COINTELPRO was about targeting First Amendment lawful political speech that the FBI could not find criminal remedies for in order to neutralize, disrupt that speech and organizing. As the Church Committee would conclude in the 1970s, COINTELPRO was a domestic covert operation designed to uphold the status quo. That's the words of the church committee, not me. The church committee would call COINTELPRO a sophisticated vigilante operation aimed squarely at preventing the exercise of First Amendment rights of speech and association on the theory that preventing the growth of dangerous groups and the propagation of dangerous ideas would protect the national security and deter violence. COINTELPRO was originally meant to target the Communist Party, but it spread out from there. It was used to target anti-war groups, civil rights groups. Infamously, the FBI tried to blackmail Martin Luther King into killing himself, the Socialist Workers Party, and the Puerto Rican Independence Movement. The most vicious acts of COINTELPRO, though, were reserved for the Black Panther Party. The FBI orchestrated a 1969 Chicago police raid on the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party after an FBI informant provided the FBI with a map of the party headquarters. During the raid, police fired nearly 100 times, killing the party's charismatic young leader, Fred Hampton, as he lay sleeping in bed. Fellow Black Panther Mark Clark was also killed. While the police claimed self-defense, a federal grand jury determined that the police had fired between 83 and 90 shots, the Panthers a maximum of one. A toxicology report showed a large amount of sedatives in Hampton's system, leading to allegations that the FBI informant had drugged Fred Hampton. Many view Hampton's death as an execution, a murder, or even an assassination. The FBI's COINTELPRO program against the Black Panther Party was designed with preventing the rise of a Black Messiah who could unify and electrify movements against white supremacy in this country. While the bulk of COINTELPRO was targeting the left, there is a very interesting COINTELPRO program into the Ku Klux Klan. This program was created because the FBI did not believe it could prosecute Klan members, not due to a lack of law, but because of the close collaboration between local law enforcement in the Jim Crow South and Klan violence. The FBI, under pressure to do something about Klan violence, then moved authority for policing the Klan out of the criminal division and into the intelligence division. The FBI had an informant in the Ku Klux Klan who told them in advance that a local police had given the Klan 15 minutes to beat up freedom riders. The FBI took no action. As the church committee made clear, the Klan COINTELPRO was the most narrowly tailored of any of the COINTELPRO programs. It was the one mostly targeted individuals suspected of violent acts, and it was far less vicious than what they did to the Black Panther Party. In the 1970s, a group of citizens, calling themselves the Citizens Commission to investigate the FBI, would break into the FBI headquarters and steal documents and reveal the existence of COINTELPRO, leading to a process of reforming the FBI. Next week, Failure to Reform, we'll be discussing this in more detail. But here's the thing. The FBI, after the Church Commission, was very, very quickly back to its old games. Just a few years after the Church Committee concluded its work, the FBI conducted a massive surveillance operation into opponents of President Ronald Reagan's foreign policy. The Bureau investigated the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, commonly called CISPIS, conducting 178 spin-off investigations, including investigations into labor unions and church groups. The FBI gathered information on 2,376 individuals and 1,330 groups. They took photos of protest, dug through trash, infiltrated meetings, attended a mass, and collected license plate numbers. They also compiled a list of hundreds of groups they claimed shared CISPIS ideology. These included left-wing groups like the Socialist Workers Party and the Democratic Socialists of America. They also included the Mary Noel Nunn Order, or the National Teachers Union, or Oxfam. When the spying was revealed, people were outraged, and 6 FBI agents were disciplined. The FBI was no longer supposed to engage in political intelligence and track and hunt subversives. How then were they spying on opponents of U.S. foreign policy? The FBI initially investigated the CISPIS under the theory they were unregistered foreign agents of a leftist guerrilla group that would later become one of El Salvador's main political parties after the Civil War. Unable to find evidence of that, they began a counterterrorism investigation into CISPIS. As we will see, counterterrorism investigations became the FBI's main vehicle for policing dissent in the United States. In the early 1990s, in the run-up to the Gulf War, the FBI did home visits to Arab Americans. How did they know where they lived? Well, as an ACLU representative at the time said to the New York Times, "One of the questions that we don't know the answer to is where do they get this list of people they're interviewing? Do they already have a list of people to be talked to in the event of a war with Iraq? That's the first thing you need to repeat the World War II experience. In addition to interviewing them about their opinions on the upcoming war, they also asked them their opinions on Palestine. As the same ACLU representative said, the FBI has long considered political support of the PLO position in the Middle East to be the equivalent of terrorist activities, and they think that gives them the right to treat people who hold those views as terrorists. There is other evidence of FBI mass surveillance of Arab or Muslim American communities during the 1990s. We know about Operation Vulgar Betrayal, which was the subject of the film The Feeling of Being Watched, which documents how the FBI put an entire community under surveillance. This mass bulk surveillance of Arab and Muslim Americans called Operation Vulgar Betrayal, I'll discuss more with Mike German later in this segment. So throughout the 1990s and the 2000s, the FBI continued its post-Church Committee practice of equating domestic dissent with terrorism. The FBI fear-mongered that one of the biggest threats was so-called ecological and animal rights terrorism. The FBI pursued animal rights and environmental activists as terrorists. In 2002 testimony to Congress on the terrorist threat, a FBI executive assistant director told Congress that anarchist and extremist socialist groups such as the Workers' World Party, Reclaim the Street, and Carnival Against Capitalism were a terrorist threat. The threat he cited included damage and vandalism during the World Trade Organization protest in Seattle. After September 11th, the powers of the FBI were expanded, and the FBI came down hard on dissent and hard on the Muslim and Arab American community. The FBI participated in the roundup of 750 Muslim immigrants that took place in the days immediately after 9/11. They increased their scrutiny of the Muslim community overall. This included the placement of confidential informants in mosques and community spaces where the FBI had no reason to suspect criminal activity was afoot. They oftentimes would let these informants act as agent provocateur. The FBI's Operation Flex is a particularly egregious case of FBI infiltration in the Muslim community and embodies the suspicionless nature of that surveillance. An FBI informant was paid to infiltrate Southern California mosque and gather personal information such as email addresses, cell phone numbers, political and religious reviews. He was even encouraged to enter into sexual relations with Muslim women in order to gather intelligence. Who was his target? Well, he asked the FBI that, and they had no identified targets, instead telling him the targets would come to him, showing that this was a broad dragnet surveillance of Muslim Americans. What happened in Operation Flex? Well, the mosque the informant was infiltrating turned him into the FBI, shocked and disturbed by the extremist comments he was making. Throughout the post-9/11 Bush years, we saw repeated spying on dissent with FBI counterterrorism investigations into PETA, into Greenpeace, and into anti-war groups. Congress ordered an Office of Inspector General review. It would not be released until 2010, and just days after this review, the FBI would be raiding the homes of Midwestern anti-war and solidarity activists claiming they were investigating material support for terrorism. While none of those activists were arrested, this investigation was not without victims. The FBI used it to target a number of two other individuals, including a Chicano rights activist Carlos Montes. Montes had a registered firearm as he was convicted of throwing a Coke can at a police officer during a protest in the 1960s. Police argued he was illegally in possession of a firearm. Montes did not know this. He did not think his firearm was illegally possessed. The LAPD raided his home, seized his computers, and FBI agents were present, and they asked him about one of the groups they raided in the Midwest, the Freedom Road Socialist Organization. These also set into motion the deportation of Rosmia O'Day. O'Day had been a U.S. citizen. She had previously lived in the occupied West Bank, where she was arrested and tortured by the Israeli military. She was convicted of a terrorist attack in an Israeli occupation military court, which has a 99.9% conviction rate. She was freed in a prisoner exchange and spoke frequently and publicly about the torture she endured. The FBI discovered she had not included this information when she applied for citizenship in the U.S., and began a trial of her for immigration fraud. While her first conviction was thrown out, she later agreed to a plea deal that allowed her to leave the U.S. without serving any jail time. In addition to this, we know the FBI spied on Occupy Wall Street. Before the first protester was in Zuccotti Park, the FBI was monitoring the case. And when Walmart heard Occupy protesters might be coming to support their workers trying to unionize, Walmart called the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. After Black Lives Matter protests broke out in Ferguson, the FBI began monitoring activists there as well. But the FBI was not merely satisfied with just that. We now know that the FBI created an intelligence threat assessment called the Black Identity Extremist Assessment. This assessment argues that perceived racism, the FBI's term, perceived racism, and anger at that racism and social injustice could lead to lethal retaliatory actions against law enforcement. What the FBI is arguing here is insidious. They are saying that certain First Amendment-protected views could lead to violence. More importantly than that, they're saying that legitimate outrage at social injustice and police violence could itself lead to violence. This is a blanket criminalizing of speech and allowing people who oppose racism to be targeted by the FBI. We know the FBI was at Standing Rock. We know they were knocking on the doors of protesters from Black Lives Matter and Occupy Cleveland they thought might protest the Republican National Convention in 2016, telling them not to go. We know that the FBI spied on anti-Keystone Pipeline protesters and put some of them on a terror watch list. And we know the FBI has been visiting Palestine Solidarity activists at their homes. The FBI additionally has visited the homes of Cuba normalization proponents. And when a young man was arrested by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials, he was visited by the FBI, who asked him about the Occupy ICE movement, telling him that he was a bad person and he should turn in his fellow Occupy ICE activist. Throughout the last 10 years, which is when our report focuses on, the FBI has repeatedly and systematically spied on anti-war speech, speech for racial and economic justice, and environmentalist. In most of these cases, the FBI cites its counterterrorism authorities to spy on these groups. How does the FBI justify this? In a number of cases, the FBI concedes the groups they're spying on are nonviolent, or that they have peaceful intentions, but it says that unknown actors or lone offenders could exploit those groups. Why those groups, not others? You could say a chess club could be infiltrated and exploited by a disgruntled individual. Certainly, I don't advocate bulk surveillance of every civil society group, but it's very clear the FBI thinks certain views are synonymous with terrorists, synonymous with criminality. And these are the same views the FBI, for 112 years, has always pursued, always persecuted, and always treated as suspicious. The FBI's legacy is one of spying on dissent. These are not isolated incidents. A door knock on the home of a Palestinian activist is not unrelated from the FBI's counterterrorism investigation into anti-Keystone Pipeline protesters. It is all part of the larger problem, which is the FBI's domestic intelligence powers have been used to spy on dissent repeatedly in this country. I'm joined today by Mike German. He is a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice, Liberty, and National Security Program. He previously worked at the American Civil Liberties Union and before that at the Federal Bureau of Investigation. His most recent book is Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, How the New FBI Damages Democracy. Mike, thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess I'm going to get started with the most obvious question people might be wondering. How does one go from working for the FBI to the ACLU and the Brennan Center? Career switch.
Awkwardly, I think. I certainly wouldn't have thought when I was going through the FBI Academy that I would end up at the ACLU before my FBI career was done. But I had a friend from college who knew that I wanted to join the FBI since I was a kid and said, you know, I met up with him after I joined the ACLU. And he said, you know, I never could have pictured you working for the ACLU. And I said, yeah, I know, but I never could have pictured that the U.S. government would have had a torture policy. So I'm not sure I changed so much as the government changed around me.
And you were a whistleblower at the FBI, correct?
Right. After 9/11, I had been working domestic terrorism for a number of years before 9/11. And like most agents, realized that the FBI had significant problems in how it managed information. But after 9/11, knowing a little bit about how terrorism worked, I became very concerned about how the FBI was changing. And also knowing a lot about the FBI's past. So when I started hearing terminology being resurrected that was directly out of the COINTELPRO program, I became very concerned that that we were headed in a bad direction, and reported some misconduct in a terrorism investigation I was involved in 2002. And rather than addressing those concerns, they it retaliated against me and refused to address what I had reported to the extent of actually falsifying FBI documents.
With whiteout, right?
One document, correct, with whiteout.
A very sophisticated forgery.
Exactly. And it was interesting because by that time I had already resigned from the FBI because I thought after 2 years of trying to get something done, I realized that my future there wasn't going to be as interesting as the years that preceded it. So I reported everything to Congress, and the IG then got involved in investigating the matter, the Inspector General. And I remember being in my front yard when the investigator called me and told me that he discovered that one of the documents had been altered with whiteout, and he was very confused about, you know, why they thought they would get away with it. And I said, because they did get away with it, right? I mean, they're all fine. I'm the one who's out of the FBI. And he said, well, you know, now I've discovered it. There will be ramifications. And I said, well, we'll see. And sure enough, nobody was ever punished for having altered FBI documents for the whiteout.
And as you argue in your book, that's unfortunately more than norm with FBI whistleblowers and the exception.
Right. You know, one of the things that I tried to do with the book is make sure that I had many voices of people in the FBI, people who had exceptional records of success, following the rules, catching the criminals that they were investigating. And yet once they report misconduct within the FBI, their careers would be stalled, if not ended. Facing very serious repercussions simply because they were doing what their oath obligated them to do, right, which was to address misconduct within the FBI.
So you start off the book by describing the FBI as lawless. I just want to dig into what you mean by that.
Throughout its history, the FBI has engaged in activity that has been found to be lawless. But what I meant in that first chapter was more that there wasn't a law that limited its behavior. When the FBI was first created, it was created in a fit of executive pique where Theodore Roosevelt wanted to create a investigative bureau for the Justice Department, and Congress said no. Then when Congress went out of session, he did it anyway.
As one does.
And it was basically a fait accompli by the time Congress came back. And the fact that in the meantime, Justice Department investigations, corruption investigations against members of Congress who were opposing the creation of such a force was very helpful to changing the political atmosphere and making it very difficult for the members of Congress who feared the FBI becoming, or feared this investigative bureau, it wasn't then named the FBI, becoming a domestic spying agency. And while I think the record is pretty clear that Theodore Roosevelt wanted the FBI to be a progressive-oriented organization that chased, as he put it, the most powerful and connected individuals in the country who were involved in wrongdoing, corruption, antitrust matters, basically the types of criminals that state and local police were not capable of targeting. In fact, the FBI did very quickly turn into a domestic spying agency. It has always operated not under any sort of legal charter passed by Congress, but by attorney general guidelines, which can be changed by every attorney general and frequently have.
And they've also claimed that some of the traditional constitutional legal restraints on criminal investigations don't apply to its national security or intelligence powers, right?
Exactly. And a lot of people don't realize this, that the FBI has always had two separate functions that operate independently of one another for the most part, a criminal justice function doing law enforcement where there's evidence of criminal activity, and an intelligence agency, counterintelligence agency that tries to capture spies or other threats to national security. And on the criminal justice side, there are constitutional limitations that are very clear, not that they're always followed, but on the intelligence side, the lines are a little murkier and the conduct is conducted under a much thicker blanket of secrecy. So the FBI has always maintained that it has more leeway in that area, in that counterintelligence area, to engage in activities that wouldn't be legal in the law enforcement context.
So one of the things you take exception with that the FBI does in your book is this radicalization theory. Could you explain what that is and why you're so troubled by it?
Well, you know, just as an objective investigator, my concern with the FBI's embrace of the radicalization theory is that it's false. It's proven false by empirical research, and certainly my own investigations, undercover investigations within terrorist groups. This simplistic radicalization theory that people are exposed to dangerous ideas and that somehow infects their mind in a way that leads them inevitably towards violence is simply false. It's not correct. You know, many of the neo-Nazis I worked against, had a deep commitment to the ideology, but a lot of them didn't and simply liked making bombs or appreciated that this was a group that celebrated their violence and would have just as happily walked over to some ideological group if that group more completely embraced their violent tendencies. The people who couldn't spell Hitler, much less worry about praising him. So knowing that it was a false paradigm was problematic as an investigator while I was still in the FBI. But also knowing the way that the FBI through its history had used that concept of radicalization to broaden the targets of its investigations, not just people who are doing harm, who are engaging in violent acts, but people who are promoting social change that the FBI disagreed with. In the early 1900s, the FBI used this radicalization theory and actually created a radicals division within the FBI to target trade unionists and the labor movement.
Edgar Hoover comes into the picture.
Right. He was the first head of the radicals unit in the FBI in its toddler phase. That was before he was director. So, you know, to a certain extent, he was imposing the directives of the people above him and particularly the attorney general. But he very much embraced that mission and, you know, started creating the first lists of people who would be rounded up if there was a problem. And, you know, one of the things people have to realize, too, is that that was a period of significant public political violence, much greater than, you know, what we think of this age of terrorism since 9/11. You know, most people would be shocked at the level of violence that was going on. And yet what they found is that these massive investigations targeting what they called the ideological drivers of this violence were very ineffective in actually finding people who were planting bombs. You know, again, that radicalization theory was used once Hoover was director during the 1950s, 60s, and 70s to develop the COINTELPRO program, which famously targeted the civil rights movement, specifically Martin Luther King, but many others, also the anti-war movement, you know, which was the same back in the early part of the century where when the country was involved in conflict, people who opposed our participation in those conflicts were viewed as the enemy or in league with the enemy. So, you know, knowing how that history was not just problematic for our country as it was suppressive of our democracy, but also was damaging to the FBI. Right, that the exposure of these ideas in both periods really harmed the FBI and the reputation of the FBI. And one of the things that I think is important to recognize is, although the FBI has an outsized influence on the American public discourse and political discourse, it's a very small agency. It's only about 30,000 to 35,000 employees. And only 12,000 of those are badge and gun carrying FBI agents, and they're spread all across the country and around the world. So, without the public respect for the FBI and its mission, it couldn't function properly. And I think that's where we are now. Is, you know, the FBI has really squandered the public trust in a way that that. It's very easy for politicians to demonize it in a way that unfortunately has too much truth behind it. So I'm sure we can get into that discussion as well.
Yeah. So I just, one of the groups or one of the things the FBI has done that you talk about in your book is sort of singling out the Muslim community. And you mentioned a couple of these sorts of disturbing investigations, one of which was during the Clinton era called Operation Vulgar Betrayal, mm-hmm. and also sort of the Bush era prosecution of the Holy Land Five Foundation. And one of the things I think a lot of people would be very disturbed about that you talk about in your book is sort of the role of basically professional Islamophobes in sort of influencing the FBI's worldview. Could you talk about that?
Sure. So, you know, the FBI doesn't exist in a vacuum. Right. It's part of our culture. So just as there are bigots of various forms in our society, that kind of bigotry is also going to exist in the FBI. And unfortunately, the FBI remains a predominantly white male organization. So when you're trying to gauge what the generalized viewpoint of FBI agents is, you know, look around for the positions that white males often take, and it's probably pretty realistic. So what we see over and over again is that advocacy groups that have a particular point of view, particularly a right-wing point of view, are able to gin up concerns about particular groups and frame the security problems in a way that scapegoats particular groups. And, you know, in the 1990s and before that, there were groups that advocated for very hostile U.S. foreign policy positions against Arab countries, Arab and Muslim countries, and particularly demonized Islam as inherently threatening to Americans. And unfortunately, those groups had some influence within the FBI. And so I sort of trace in the book the history of the rhetoric that these groups used and how it influenced FBI policy and FBI investigations and ultimately turned into a years-long broad-scope investigation of Muslim communities in the United States before 9/11. And that was during a time when the Attorney General guidelines had been narrowed after the current COINTELPRO program. So what I pointed out was that while those guidelines were not effective in actually preventing that type of inappropriately broad investigation, it was at least useful when some reasonable people finally looked at this case and said, you know, this is going nowhere. You're investigating hundreds of people and there's no evidence of criminal activity. So they shut the case down. Unfortunately, it took them until about 2000 to shut the case down. So after 9/11, when the FBI was struggling to come up with terrorism investigations, they turned back to this case and focused on one particular group, the Holy Land Foundation, which was then the largest Muslim charity in the United States, and used this guilt by association information and concept from this radicalization theory to justify an investigation of the leadership of the Holy Land Foundation. And a strange investigation. The idea was they were providing material support to Hamas. But the government acknowledged they didn't actually give any money to Hamas or to any group that was bringing money to Hamas, but rather that any charitable works done in the occupied territories somehow benefited Hamas because Hamas could claim credit for that charitable work. So there was no allegation that the charitable donations that the Holy Land Foundation gave to groups in the occupied territories didn't go to the charitable purpose. They did go to the charitable purpose. The government's argument was that any charity, any group gives in the occupied territories has a benefit to Hamas and therefore is materially supporting Hamas. And of course, that makes no sense. And the defense attorneys for the Holy Land Foundation pointed out that the Red Cross had given money to the same groups that the Holy Land Foundation had, that the USAID had given money to the same groups that the Holy Land Foundation had. So it's really an extraordinary case. And I think historians will look back on that case as an incredible travesty of justice.
And the government actually tries the case twice, because I believe the first trial ends in a hung jury or a mistrial, and then they go back and secure
right.
a conviction.
The first
trial, quite lengthy sentences, I think.
Right. The first trial ended in a hung jury, and in fact, one acquittal of one of the people who was tried. So it took a second trial, and there were some strange allowances that the judge gave to the prosecution during the second trial that were unheard of in American jurisprudence, letting an intelligence officer or official from Israel testify in alias so that the defense couldn't look into that person's background. There were a number of serious anomalies, and yet this was about 2005, I think, was the second trial. So it was still when there was a significant amount of public fear about Al-Qaeda and terrorism in general. So I think it was an easy way for the government to use the fear of terrorism. And one of the issues was they were able to show the aftermath of Hamas terrorist attacks, even though, again, there was no allegation that money went directly to Hamas or that any money was diverted to a terrorist purpose. But again, the whole idea is to just create that sense of fear within the jury to result in convictions. And most dangerous in that case was that the government released a list of what they called unindicted co-conspirators. That is a term of art in the law, which allows the government prosecutors to use hearsay evidence when somebody who they name as an unindicted co-conspirator could otherwise object to it. Typically, the Justice Department doesn't allow the release of that information because the key word is unindicted. These are people who are not charged with a crime. And the reason that the unindicted co-conspirators are supposed to remain sealed is that it creates an implication of wrongdoing without any opportunity to defend themselves. So on that list were some of the largest Muslim organizations in the United States. And unfortunately, it smeared them in a way that has haunted them and all the people that they represent for years, and has been used as a cudgel sort of in this circular system where these advocates generate concerns about a particular group. The FBI does an investigation and puts out evidence that these anti-Muslim advocates can then use to expand their Islamophobic mission.
And in addition to talking about how the FBI has singled out the Muslim community, you also talk about how they've singled out sort of Asian Americans. And I think that's a story that's a little bit less known. Could you talk about some of what you found there?
Sure. So, you know, again, the FBI is predominantly and on this in the counterintelligence field, you know, particularly after the Soviet Union dissolved, the FBI had to find a new enemy, a new national security threat. And because China is a very big country and has still has a communist government, that was this sort of obvious choice that we'll make China the threat. And, you know, many Asian Americans know that there's a long history of discrimination against these groups, particularly in the national security context. World War II, the internment of the Japanese, but even before that, you know, one of the first immigration laws passed in the United States was the Chinese Exclusion Act. So there has long been a deep strain of discrimination against Asians. And in this national security context, there was a deep-seated and remains a deep-seated belief that Asians Americans and particularly Chinese Americans are somehow more susceptible to being recruited by Chinese spies to spy for China. In fact, the evidence does not support that. There are plenty of white Americans who have been convicted of spying for China. But that remains a deep-seated belief. And I pointed or described in a couple of cases in the FBI where Chinese-American FBI agents who had extraordinary records of success became targets of inappropriate suspicion within the FBI, and their careers were effectively ended based on rank discrimination because of their Asian heritage rather than because of any evidence of wrongdoing. And in fact, it later turned out that their supervisor, who was a white male, was the person who was leaking FBI information to a Chinese accused double agent. And information was getting back to China. So those are just examples of how this distorted that a national security focus that's distorted by this bias can actually harm our national security, because the FBI was misdirected to look at people because of their background and ethnicity rather than because of any evidence of wrongdoing. And if they had focused on the evidence of wrongdoing from the beginning, they would have more quickly identified the people who were actually violating public trust.
And how does this sort of fear of the other on the part of the FBI impact how they view First Amendment protected speech?
I think it's fundamental. And I also think it's somewhat natural, right? If you're the government and somebody is criticizing government policy that you're enforcing, it's natural to view that person as threatening. That's why we have to make sure that we have very strong guidelines to govern the behavior of the investigators to make sure that they're not falling prey to that kind of bias. But it's again, long history of the FBI of targeting dissent as a national security threat, and particularly when that dissent is targeted against the most powerful people, you know, kind of the opposite of what Theodore Roosevelt had articulated in his vision for what this Justice Department Investigative Bureau would be doing. The FBI ends up being the protectors of the privileged rather than people who are putting the privileged in fear of investigation when they violate the law.
You use a really interesting example of this in your book. You talk about sort of this website called antiwar.com, which some people may be familiar with. It's a libertarian website, but it's very critical of U.S. foreign policy. And I believe it was on September 12th, 2001, right after September the 11th, they got a threatening email, which they reported to the FBI, and they themselves end up getting investigated by the FBI.
It was an amazing case that I was involved in when I was at the ACLU. As you said, antiwar.com is a libertarian.
They're libertarian, yes. But very much so.
And antagonistic to U.S. foreign policy, particularly as it involves military means. And, you know, people have criticized it, I don't think unfairly, for delving into the conspiratorial as well. But it is entirely a journalistic enterprise. You know, it has editors, they publish articles, it's a web-based platform. It's not by any means any kind of threat to anyone. But after 9/11, because of their anti-war views, somebody saw an article they didn't like and threatened to shut down the website. So they sent a threatening email to the editor of antiwar.com, Eric Garris, and he didn't know what to do. Right? He said, I talked with him extensively about it, and he said, you know, he'd received that kind of threat before, but after 9/11, it seemed a little more serious. So he decided that he would call the FBI and ask for advice on how to handle it. And the duty agent who answered the phone said, well, send us the email. We'll take a look at it. You know, with everything else going on, you know, it's probably nothing to worry about. If you don't hear from us, it means that there's no big deal. Don't worry about it. So he sends the email, doesn't hear back, and doesn't think about it again. But several years later, a completely unrelated entity had done a Freedom of Information Act request about this kind of conspiracy theory around an FBI arrest of some Israeli Israelis that had been in the United States on September 11th and were filming and dancing in a spot where they could view the Twin Towers burning. And the story was highly exaggerated from the beginning, but like most conspiracy theories, it had some truth to it, that there were a group of Israelis who were in the United States apparently working, even though they were here on a tourist visa, so arguably in violation of the immigration laws, who happened to be in New Jersey across the river from New York on 9/11. And after the attacks, obviously, you know, smoke pouring out of the buildings, it was a very shocking thing. And for whatever reason, some bystanders thought their behavior was inappropriate. You know, doing FBI undercover work, one of the things we taught new agents was, you know, there's no normal reaction to an abnormal situation. You know, people act strangely in these situations. And but for whatever reason, they were reported to the local police, and the FBI went out and arrested them. And, you know, it was all much ado about nothing. But a conspiracy theory sprouted that these Israelis were there to film the attacks that they had prior knowledge of. There's no evidence to suggest that's true. But somebody had done a Freedom of Information Act request to get information about these arrests. And in publishing the material they got from the FBI, there was a document that referenced an investigation of antiwar.com. So the ACLU helped Eric and his partner at antiwar.com to get more detailed information from the FBI. And it turned out that indeed, the FBI had not just one, but multiple times investigated antiwar.com. And it was fascinating when we got the records, because usually when I'm looking at these kind of FBI records, I look for the criminal predicate. You know, normally if the FBI is focused on investigating criminal, something that is arguably criminal, there's more justification. So in the documents, there is this reference to materials that the FBI analyst was concerned about that were on antiwar.com. And when they looked up the people involved in antiwar.com, one of them had threatened to shut down the FBI's website and referenced the original email that Eric had sent to the FBI about a person threatening to shut down antiwar.com, not threatening to shut down the FBI. But this error in interpretation stuck around. And even though some analysts would read an article they didn't like on antiwar.com and would want an investigation. And the investigation would start. They would gather all kinds of background on Eric and his partner. And then somebody would shut the investigation down. But every couple of years, this would happen. And so Eric and antiwar.com ended up suing the FBI. And it was a years-long battle to get the FBI to take this erroneous information that Eric Garris had threatened to shut down the FBI's website out of the system. And the FBI strongly resisted that, but ultimately was ordered to. But it's sort of a good example, not just of how the FBI views dissent against U.S. policy as a potential threat, but how bad information lingers. And you know, even recognizing this was false information, the FBI didn't want to get rid of it because they believe all information is valuable, even if it's factually incorrect. So you could see how this wasted effort wasn't just an invasion of the First Amendment rights of Eric and antiwar.com and its readers, but a complete threat to our security, because there are real threats out there. And when the FBI investigators are wasting time chasing these spurious types of investigations of people they just don't like because of their viewpoint, it doesn't make anyone safer.
So that's a really, that story really illustrates your larger point. So I guess my final question for you is, you were an FBI agent for I believe 16 years. When you were researching this book, did you come across anything that just shocked you?
Yeah, certainly. I was not aware of the vulgar betrayal case that we'd spoken of. You know, like I said, I worked on the criminal justice side, and that case worked more as an intelligence gathering operation. So I was surprised at the breadth of that investigation. You know, in the 1990s, I would have thought that FBI managers would have been more circumspect, particularly after the CISPIS investigation, which was a 1980s investigation.
And that's a committee in solidarity with the people of El Salvador. We put it right, on exactly. That act.
That had started during the Reagan administration, when there was a dirty war going on in El Salvador and U.S. foreign policy. There were a number of American groups resisting U.S. foreign policy in a solidarity movement to protect political refugees from El Salvador in the United States. But it again, sort of the acorn that created that investigation came from these right-wing advocacy groups that were trying to present the resistance to U.S. foreign policy as a threat. And it started a years-long investigation that was nationwide and overbroad. But they got caught when some FBI files were accidentally leaked to the public. And it was one of the first times that you saw FBI managers actually be punished for their management of an investigation. So when I was beginning my undercover cases targeting neo-Nazis, the FBI managers were extremely hesitant and concerned that it wasn't that it would broaden out into some political investigation, which was nowhere near our intentions. And certainly we had significant evidence that neo-Nazis that we were investigating had engaged in illegal activities and acts of violence. So that there was an investigation going on at that same time that was as broad as vulgar betrayal, that identified, I think it said 500 different groups, that Muslim American groups that were under investigation, surprised me, certainly. I would not have believed that that type of investigation could have happened during that period. So that was a bit of a learning experience while I was doing that research. And I would not have thought that would have been possible.
And both the CISPIS and Vulgar Betrayal, those are intelligence investigations.
So Vulgar Betrayal was interesting because there was both sides. Basically they were alleging that again, kind of with the same theory that ultimately was successful in the prosecution of Holy Land Foundation, where any support to any group in the occupied territories somehow has a side benefit to Hamas, and therefore is any humanitarian aid being provided into the occupied territory it's somehow tainted by criminality. There was a law enforcement side of that investigation that, it, again, had not been successful before 9/11. And it was only after 9/11 and they could make this completely false connection to Al-Qaeda terrorism targeting the United States that that I think that they were able to use that innuendo and guilt by association to convince a jury that these people were somehow engaged in something that should be prohibited.
Mike, it was a pleasure talking to you. And the book is called Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, How the New FBI Damages Democracy. And I highly recommend it. It's an excellent book. And thank you again for joining us.
Thank you, Chip. And thanks for all your hard work on these issues and others.